And welcome to The Truth About Fiction. I'm Lynn Michelle.
And I'm Derek Thompson.
And we're going to talk about the whole hard, grinding business of being a writer, of writing and being published.
We're going to shatter some myths, break some hearts, and hopefully bring you something inspiring. But most of all, we will tell it how it is. Thanks for joining the Truth About Fiction podcast. This session, I'm delighted to be joined by Dave Brown, who... who has his own very successful podcast called The Bullshit Detective. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Derek. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. Dave has kind of volunteered or been press-ganged into joining me today to really just talk about books and see where that takes us.
I've never considered myself to be a very good podcast host. I've been on a very few, but because it's you, I think this will be different.
Let's hope so. I delight in failing to meet other people's expectations.
I don't have any, and I think that's the beauty of the format or the non-format that you have, the same as the non-format that I have, is just... get on with a guest and chat some shit.
Exactly. So what about those books, eh? Before we started, before I figured out how to record the bloody thing, you were talking about a short attention span for music, books and television. So I suppose what I wondered generally is, does that put you off reading books or long books?
I go through phases, I would say. I go through phases of you know, either fiction or non-fiction, reading lots or not reading much at all. I can't remember the last time I picked up a book. I mean, it wouldn't be years ago, but it would probably be months ago when I've actually sat down and read a book. So I tend to get into a genre or a particular author and then like read everything that they've ever written. So I just go with that, really. I don't subscribe to this, you know, you have to read this many books a year and all that sort of nonsense that you see on social media. It's like, read when you feel like it.
I think. Are you a fan of stopping a book if you think this just isn't working for me?
Didn't used to be. I used to be the kind of person I would just stick with it and just drag myself through it and hate it. But now, yeah, I've got a number of not any fiction books, but I've got some non-fiction books that I've been kind of reading or started reading. I've got one right in front of me actually, which is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. So it's all about our brains, how they work, and it's an academic book, but an easier to read one. But yeah, and I'm about, what am I, a third of the way through, and I got a third of the way through about 6 months ago.
Sorry to interrupt. I don't think I've ever given up on a non-fiction book, but I have fiction. I was reading one once, genuinely, in the bath, and it fell in, and I consider that a mercy killing. I won't mention a book. I mean, I have to loads of people elsewhere, but now I think, you know, life's too short to read stuff that doesn't grab you or listen to stuff that doesn't grab you.
Yeah, well, I suppose as I say that, I tend to get into a particular, like I say, genre, or actually normally it's a particular author, so that I kind of know I'm gonna get more of the same.
Name an author that you were hooked on and plowed through, as it were.
So through my life, I mean, I suppose the earliest one I can remember as a kid was Enid Blyton.
Yeah.
Clive Barker. Yeah. Hellraiser, that kind of thing. James Herbert, The Rats.
I love James Herbert. We all read The Rats, didn't we, as kids?
Yeah.
Well, as teens. The Rats and Sepulchre. The Lair, I think, was the follow-up.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So that was another one. Latterly, most recently, Frederick Backman. So if anyone ever asks what my favourite book is, it's A Man Called Ove.
Now that's interesting, because a friend of mine gave me that book. She said, you'll love this. And I didn't love it quite so much.
Yeah, I think that's kind of problematic, though, isn't it? When someone says you'll love this, immediately, I don't know, perhaps raises your expectations, maybe makes you more critical.
Like those books that say... the best of its kind, you'll never read another book, and you kind of go into it thinking, yeah, for sure.
It's the same with films, it's the same with music. I think that the hype can build these things up and actually kind of ruin the experience.
What kind of bird is that in the background?
I've no idea. A tweeting bird. It might be, I don't know.
I'm a bit of a birder. I think that the first book I can remember as an adult really being hooked on was a Harlan Coben book called Tell No. Brilliant film as well, French film. And I can remember being up till about 1:30 in the morning. I was at some work conference training thing because I could not leave it until the point of about to fall asleep. And after that, as you were saying, with Frederick Backman. Then I started to read all of his books. And as you say, they are kind of, I think, for series. And I won't say it's an accusation, but it's been put to me with some of mine as well, that they're sort of different but the same. Because obviously there's, yes, there's a formula, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's sort of comforting.
Yeah, so, I mean, Ian Rankin, I don't know if it's all of his books, but it must have been close to, if not all. I have these phases of reading, and I have literally started a book and just read it continuously, and just, yeah, you know, if it's taken more than a day, I've gone to sleep and then got up in the morning and read it again, sort of, and finished reading it. So, you know, like sort of 2 days to read a book. But I'm just not really that into reading at the moment. And I think that's probably because I'm, you know, doing the podcast stuff. So I'm, yeah, sort of focusing on my own creation, if you like. And it's just been today I've decided to change my approach to my podcast slightly. Still 5 minutes a day. But what I normally do is I do the podcast and then I think of the title.
Yeah.
But now I'm going to think of a title and do the podcast about it.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that to give you a sort of anchor, or just to see what happens?
I think it's just to see what happens. And it's also, I can straight away, by doing that, I did the first one today, which will go out on Friday. So it gives me a bit of flexibility in that I'm not just talking about what's going on that day. Right. So I can maybe just get a few episodes done in advance, because it's become a bit sort of monotonous for me doing it the way I was doing it. But it's also to explore why those three words. You know, how do I relate to those three words? What do they mean to me? Why have I chosen them? Or why do I think I've chosen them?
And do you choose them at random, or?
Well, the latest episode is called Edward Cabbage Hands. Okay, so the podcast is essentially, so it's, there's two perspectives. It's to have a play around with those words. Yeah. And then in this case, how do I relate to those words? Well, let's actually, Edward Scissorhands, but cabbages. So it's a bit of talk about how I relate to that character. You know, he's an outsider. He's, you know, some people are frightened of him, all that kind of stuff. And I do relate to that. Yet he has these abilities that other people don't have.
Yeah. And he's, you know, got amazing lawyers.
And yes. The whole, yeah, AI thing, they were saying, you know, on TikTok, I don't know what it was, 15-20% of the sort of the pro Johnny Depp stuff was created by bots, for example.
I suppose after the US election, they needed to do something with them.
Yeah, well, exactly. And well, this is the scary part for me, mm-hmm, of all of that, is that, you know, people, I think it was Paul Graham who was on the long podcast, but he sort of posted about that. People, you know, it plays on people wanting to belong to something. Yeah, they want to be part of the masses. Not everybody, but a lot of people do. They just buy into the bullshit, don't they?
Well, it's the tribalism, isn't it? It's the, yeah, almost safety in numbers. I mean, in a sort of booky sense, there are books that are immensely popular, or they're promoted as immensely popular, which becomes the same thing, like self-fulfilling prophecy, like the bots. You know, someone makes a decision about whether this is art or whether this is literature, whatever that means these days, and other people get on board and it becomes thus. But you are a bit of a free thinker, do you?
Yeah, I mean, what, I think so.
Yeah, no, I think you are. You know, we've chatted before and I've listened to a lot of your stuff. That's my go-to.
Yeah.
When I should be working. I suppose what I'm wondering is, as a free thinker, in terms of experiencing other people's creativity, whether it's books, music, art, other, are you swayed by the marketing, do you think?
I suppose to some degree I am, you know, because we all are, and we can't control that. I suppose it's the degree to which I'm swayed. I mean, if I think of, not so much books, because they're not advertised so much, are they?
Well, it depends if they're e-books. Yeah. Well, if they're e-books, they are.
On kind of where you spend your time and what you look at. So I suppose that's yes, but I suppose I'd like to think I can make my own judgment. So, you know, I think the thing with sort of marketing is that a lot of people don't want to be the person who doesn't like it. They don't want to be the person to say, oh, I didn't really enjoy that. And I think a big component of that is how you feel at the time. Do you know what I mean? It's like if you go and see if you read a funny book or go and see a funny movie and you're not very happy, you're not going to enjoy it as much in terms of what it's there for. But I suppose what I've learned to do is to take from these various, you know, mediums what I take from them, rather than to take this kind of imposed thing that I'm supposed to experience. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in terms of the arts, there's always a degree of marketing. Otherwise, we wouldn't hear about it in the first place.
Yes.
So someone has put it before us. I mean, I don't know. I don't know many people who find a book or a film or an album by osmosis. The only time I can think of doing it is Kevin Smith's film Dogma, which I still think is hilarious. The one with Matt Damon and Ben Affleck in it.
Yep.
I remember going into a video shop. So that tells you how long ago this is. In Cornwall, and there was so many people who'd said, I've read somewhere this is a terrible film, and I thought, well, how terrible can it be? And when I saw the cover and the premise, it just looked brilliant. And obviously on the cover they always give you the positive reviews. Took it home and it became my favorite film. But as you say, the critics, whoever they are, and for whatever reason, hated it, probably for the language, the drug references, the blasphemy, the fact that Alanis Morissette was playing God, as you do.
Yep.
But yeah, as you're right, the context in which we encounter these things is really interesting because it can change everything.
Well, yeah, and marketing isn't about the art in itself. It's about selling the art.
Yeah.
You know, so the marketing is about pushing something that's going to, well, that they think is going to sell. And actually, just the fact that it's been chosen as something that's going to sell means it's more likely to. Maybe more true of sort of art, as in paintings, sculptures, that kind of thing, than something like movies.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know with books, certainly ebooks, because they exist in, you know, online virtually, they kind of effectively lent to you. I've always wondered what happens if someone buys an ebook and then the publisher or the author of it self-published withdraws it from publication, where it disappears from your Kindle because it doesn't exist anymore, you know, once it's synced with the mainframe.
I suppose it depends whether you've actually bought it or not, or if you're on some kind of subscription thing.
Yeah, I don't know, because can you buy something? Well, yeah, I suppose, like you say, if you bought it, then in theory you've got it offline.
Yeah.
And
but I struggle with with audiobooks and ebooks. I like a book, a paper book.
I like a book, but I'd love to have an audiobook of one of my books, of course.
Would you read it yourself? Famous person would you have?
I would. Oh, do you know, I've never been asked that. It would have to be someone with better diction. I'd have you do it, probably, actually.
Right, okay.
Because you've got an easy listening voice. But it definitely wouldn't be me unless I was writing about someone in a sinus clinic. I don't know. It would probably have to be someone who can do a London accent somewhat.
Right.
Ideally, actually, I'd have it as a kind of radio play. That there's some brilliant. I'm a big fan of Raymond Chandler. And the BBC, years and years ago, did a whole series which were mainly produced by a fantastic producer called Sasha Yevtushenko. And they were great. It was a play, essentially, as an audiobook. And I've listened to them so many times, they really kind of capture you. But one of the things that interests me about books generally is this argument about the environmental benefits. Because people who love ebooks will say, we don't cut down trees. However, of course, the technology required for ebooks, all the kit that has to be created and the materials to create the Kindles and iPads and what have you, also an environmental impact. It's just interesting how one choice, and we're back to marketing, can be packaged and sold to people in a particular way while conveniently ignoring the sort of downsides. A bit like electric cars. You know, electric cars are a brilliant idea as long as you can recharge them.
Well, and look, I mean, I think this is sort of typical, isn't it? Anything seemingly good has a downside, and we often don't. You know, we don't find, the general public don't actually find out what that downside is. So, you know, it's like the whole Bitcoin thing.
Yeah.
It's all just, you know, just floating about in clouds. But actually, it's consuming a huge amount of energy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now we know about that. But actually, you know, do we ever see any sort of comparisons? So, yeah, we don't really know the real cost of things like ebooks, do we?
No. I mean, you'd think there'd be a study by now, wouldn't you? There's studies on everything else.
Yeah, but studies are generally paid for by people who've got an agenda.
Yeah, I remember the old cigarettes are good for you ads in the 50s.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
Do you remember the sweet cigarettes we had as kids?
Yeah.
Superman, of all people.
Madness, isn't it? So what are we being kidded about now? Do you know what I mean?
It's being kidded in.
I mean, I've seen adverts for, you know, advertising cigarettes is good for your lungs.
But do you keep books for a long time? Do you have sort of treasured books from decades ago?
I used to, but I don't anymore. I tend to give them to a charity shop or give them to someone that I think might like them. So I don't actually have many books. I used to have a, you know, bookshelf full of them, but I tend to read something and move on.
That's interesting.
As opposed to reread it. There are a few books I've reread, but not many. Same with films. There aren't many films that I've watched more than once.
God, I can think of a few that I've watched loads of times.
But then I'm a seeker of of new stuff. So same with music. I listen to Radio 6 probably more than anything else because it's a bit of a mixture. So there's some stuff I've obviously heard before, but there's also some stuff that I haven't really listened to before. I might have, you know, heard it in passing. But I also, so I get fed lots of stuff that's new to me. And lots of stuff that is actually genuinely new, well, as new as music can be, given that I've heard so much of it.
In terms of your previous reading, have you ever sort of fairly recently read any of the so-called classics, i.e. old books, or do you always just go for fiction? Do you just go for whatever's current at the time?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever read any of the classics. Interesting, isn't it? It's just never grabbed my attention.
I wonder if that's because how they're sort of pitched. I mean, I'm quite a fan of Thomas Hardy, who, you know, if you've ever had a friend who's just that little bit too upbeat.
Yeah.
They're not full of themselves, but whatever the situation, always smiling. Give them a couple of Thomas Hardy novels and that would take a smile right off their face. I mean, it's like a Greek tragedy, but in West Country form.
Yeah, I suppose it's interesting. I'm same with film, same with music. So it's not something that is specific to books.
Right.
Although, saying that, I have had periods in my life with music where I mean there was one point I was getting into all this sort of, I don't know, personal development stuff, whatever you want to call it, and at one point I listened to my entire CD collection, so this was about 300 CDs. So whenever I was listening to music, I was listening to the next one in alphabetical order.
Wow.
And god, that was hard work. I mean, I had to listen to Vanilla Ice's album and a bit of Mariah Carey, you know, and these not just the hits, so not just even slightly bearable, but just all the rubbish that's also on the album. And then I gave them all away to a friend.
So was it a deliberate choice that you thought, right, I must listen to this in full before I ditch it?
Yes, it was a time in my life when I was trying to fill in some gaps. So I think that was not that filled in some musical gaps, but it's kind of like, I just need to get through this and then I can move on from it. And so it's metaphorical. And from then I did start to listen to, that's kind of when I started just going for the new, but also I have listened to some older stuff, but I tend to listen to older stuff if I find out more about the people involved. I watch a documentary on telly. Now I'm interested, actually. Now, I mean, I remember I'd never listened really to any of the Beatles apart from just whatever comes up on the radio.
Yeah.
But I read a book about Charles Manson and the White Album. So that was he'd made all these weird connections with Beatles songs and this, you know, this war against, you know, between black and white, and, you know, that was his big picture, wasn't it? So I listened to that album a number of times. But yeah, if I watch a documentary and then I'll go and listen to a bit of the music, because that just piques my interest.
So the context changes.
Yeah. So it's more about, look, I'm interested in people.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. So documentaries about people, famous or otherwise. I'd much rather watch a movie. I know I'm talking a lot about movies, but the same weirdly. So with a movie, I'd like watching movies about real people or with a real connection to a real story.
Yeah.
With books, I don't enjoy reading books about people, real people.
So you never read
autobiographies? I'm not really into, apart from, there's one I read that was really good, and that was Open by Andre Agassi. That was an interesting, it was a different kind of book to just finding out where he went to school and all that kind of stuff. It was more about his challenges with his father and all that kind of thing.
Did you know it was going to be like that when you started reading it?
No, I can't remember. I was actually coaching a lot of people in sport at the time.
Oh, of course.
Like the mental stuff. Yeah. So I did start to sort of gather a few autobiographies. So no, I think it was just one of a number, most of which are very dull. So that was one that stands out to me now. It's a book I recommend.
Oh, okay. Well, the most recent autobiography I read was Bob Mortimer's.
Yes, me too.
Which I just thought it was brilliant because it's, I mean, obviously a lot of the time, because I mean, I haven't worked with autobiographies, but I've done ghostwriting for people for speeches and other bits and pieces, articles. But for that book of Bob's, you just get a total sense of his personality all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, I've been watching him for years.
Yeah.
You know, even sort of with Reeves and Mortimer, he's my favourite. And Gone Fishing.
You know, with Paul Whitehouse,
you know, I don't know, there's something, it's the comedy and the tragedy, isn't it, all combined?
Yeah, he's a very,
Mortimer, I think.
He's a very wistful person. You don't see that very often these days, do you?
No, no, so he's just a very interesting character. So yes, same here. And again, that was a book I just sat down. I mean, it's not a very, very long book either, is it?
No, it's an easy read.
I read it in one sitting.
Yeah.
Just flew through it. That probably is a book that I would consider picking up again and reading again.
I think, but I'd like to read, I haven't seen if there's one around in paperback that's cheap, I'd like to read an autobiography of Barry Quire.
Yeah. And I think actually this conversation now, it's what I found is going through this sort of process with my podcast and this, I don't know, whatever it is, a bloody trying to work out what the hell I'm going to do with my life. I found myself getting more interested in those kind of stories.
Yeah.
So I listen to a lot of podcasts where there are guests, but you know, Adam Buxton is a podcast that's probably one of my,
yeah,
certainly my top three, because he has predominantly funny people on there, comedians. Richard Herring as well, he does a,
yeah, Richard Herring's very good.
These live podcasts. So listening to one, Stuart Lee today. So again, he's just a character. Stuart Lee is a character that interests me. I mean, I find him very funny. I know he's a bit Marmite, isn't he?
I think I've seen him twice. Once we got tickets for free, which was just fantastic. He was supported by Henning Venn. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
No, he's brilliant. Again, so I'm sort of, you know, I've got these favourite podcasts, but I won't necessarily listen to Adam Buxton's. I listen to every episode.
Yeah.
Richard Herring, not necessarily. It depends who it is. So I'm drawn to certain characters, which gives me something to go away and think about after this. Actually, it's like, what are the commonalities?
Well, I think you relate to them.
Well, no, exactly. But then it's the why. It's a bit like the Edward Scissorhands thing. It's like, why?
Yeah.
It's like, I relate to this character, but why? What is it? What are the qualities they have?
What I like about the Edward Cabbage Hands idea is the irony is he can't slice them, can he?
Well, I mean, this
doesn't have the scissors.
Podcasting him. Well, it's like, I mean, the things to consider is like, are you actually growing the cabbages out of the end of your arms? Like, do they continue to grow? Because it would be very handy for feeding sort of small animals, wouldn't it?
Yeah, somewhat. Animals.
But if you feed a rabbit, it's going to take a few leaves. And then, you know, if you feed a horse, it's just going to have the whole cabbage, isn't it? Both cabbages probably in one sitting. Then what happens before you got cabbages back?
I think my concern is that it would really be Edward Scissorhands who's just spiked some cabbages on to trick people.
Maybe just to appear safer.
To appear, well, that's it. It would be health and safety and promoting a green agenda.
Yeah, I'm not sure cabbages are the best way of stopping him cutting people. He'd have to have quite a lot of cabbages, wouldn't he? Or a Brussels sprout on the end of each.
Oh, but a Brussels sprout, isn't that like a small cabbage anyway?
I think so.
It's a brassica. There, my horticultural knowledge ends.
It's way beyond my horticultural knowledge. So anyway, yes, books. I don't know. It's we're not really on track with books here, are we? But I suppose it's
we are. We're not. I mean, there's
whether it's books, films, music, they're the same thing to me. Just a different way of presenting it. There's a different relationship with it in terms of our senses.
I think that, I mean, obviously in the old days, people remember where they were when they bought albums, and there's an emotional and a physical connection with that. Now, of course, not everybody, I still buy vinyl.
Yep.
The records, not the clothes.
No.
But that's a different podcast. The same with books. You were talking about physical books. I mean, there is, I don't know if it's comforting, but there's something very tactile about having books. I mean, I have some old books, so I keep, unlike your good self, I keep a lot of books. And some of the books that I bought years ago are now considered sort of vintage. I found out completely accidentally that one of the books I bought, I think for fiver from someone years ago, is now worth about £200.
Wow.
It's ridiculous on two counts. One, I've never read the bloody thing in, let's say, at least 30 years. I bought it cheap. And it was hardback, and I thought, and I knew it was collectible then. I thought, I must have that, and it sat on the shelf and gathered dust. I don't know what that's about.
Well, you made 195 quid out of it, so...
Well potentially, yeah, if I sell it, but there's a part of you that says, oh, but you might read it.
Well, no, I used to be like that, and it was like, read a book, put it on the shelf, read a book, put it on the shelf, and so on, and just amass more and more books. I suppose what's interesting about it, if you think about the different, you know, if you think about, you know, books, movies, and music... You know, we interact with these things with our five senses. Some might say there's more than five, but to different degrees. You know, so obviously reading a book is a visual experience, but there's also a visual imagination component to it.
Yeah.
So we imagine the characters etc. We imagine what's going on. We, you know, I don't know, people do it to different degrees. You know, music is different. It's through our ears, so it's not necessarily visual. You don't see the music. Even if you go and see a band, you don't see the music. You see the band and you hear
the
music.
That's really interesting from what you said, because, as you say, I mean, the thing about music, unlike books and cinema, is the imagination isn't really engaged unless you've got your eyes shut and you're just seeing where the music takes you or the lyrics.
Yeah. So I really struggle with audiobooks. I don't struggle with podcasts because I don't feel like I have to follow them as closely. Right. I'm not going to lose track of the story. And if I'm driving and I've tried listening to an audiobook, I'm just constantly rewinding it. Struggle to take it in.
Listening to audiobooks or stories is almost entirely in the car on journeys. Yeah. So for lockdown, nobody went anywhere. So I didn't listen to any for the longest time. It would feel strange to me to just sit down at home and think, oh, I'll just put on an audiobook.
Yeah, I'm a bit like that with podcasts. So most of my podcasts I listen to when I'm driving, so I don't really listen to the radio much unless I've got passengers, and then we put the radio on. But yeah, audiobooks, I just can't. Even if I actually sit and listen to one, my mind just wanders.
Does it wander where the book is going? Do you start?
No, it just wanders off somewhere else entirely. So I will, if I'm in the car, I'd have driven for 10 miles, and then, oh shit, I should be listening to this.
See, I think maybe with books, where I don't know, fascination is the right word. It's one of the things you do, what used to be, I don't know about now. I remember visiting a school as a volunteer classroom, if you can call it a classroom. It looked like NASA. There were all these kids behind big, and this is some years ago, behind big screens in the learning room or whatever they called it. And the teacher would be up on a little podium and it would be, OK, switch your screens on now. But when I was a kid, you know, you had reading time. There were books in the class that you could borrow. And I think that's where the love of reading for me began, as it did for most people of our generation.
Yeah, I was just trying to think. I mean, yeah, I don't think I read much at school, apart from the things we were, you know, told to read or being read to. You know, you go around the class and everyone would read a bit of a book. I used to draw, I think, when I had those, you know, you get those free periods when you can just do something. So most of my reading, so if I think back to Enid Blyton, for example, that was all done outside of school. That was all at home. That was all, you know, get home and read. So I think that's where my love of reading. I don't read loads and loads, or I'm not at the moment, but I do love reading. But I've got to be going through one of those phases. But then I think that's probably how I am anyway. I've got to feel like doing something. I remember it was my old auntie. She said, you're really good at doing the things you want to do.
Wear that as a badge of honour.
No, absolutely. You know, because I don't think that is true. People are, I suppose, generally good at the things they want to do in terms of committing to it, but so many people do loads of stuff that they don't really want to do, and that's kind of my mission at the moment, is to find that path in life.
There's this idea which I disagree with, that you spend 10,000 hours on anything and you'd be brilliant at it. I remember going to dance classes to try and learn tango, and it was just awful. I did back into a chair at one point, but
yeah,
I remember saying to the teacher, because I was getting really frustrated with it, my other half is great at dancing, and she was saddled with me, unfortunately for her. And I said, everyone's got his natural rhythm in them. She said, yeah. And I said, I don't have that. I really don't. You know, there's mechanics, but there's no flow. Yeah. She said, no, everyone. Well, by the end of the class, she'd come around to my way of thinking.
Yeah, so I suppose it depends on what the thing is that you're doing 10,000 hours of. You know, there's a... I don't know, if you look at sport, for example, there's a big genetic component to that.
Definitely. You know,
you know, basketball, for example, you know, if you're tall, then you're probably going to be better than someone who's shorter. Although there are the outliers, there are still people who manage to be very, really successful, and they don't fit that, you know, that size requirement or whatever. And I suppose the thing is, if you continue to do 10,000 hours, it might all just fall into place at some point. Keep doing it. If you think about my podcast, it's like I've done 214 5-minute episodes, one every day.
Yeah.
And there have been times when it's like, I don't know why the fuck I'm doing this, and I don't want to do it, and I have to force myself to do it. And now I've got to a point where it's like, right, I'm going to change it now. I'm going to do something slightly different and see how that goes. So I don't know, perhaps, and it's the same as if you look at the education system, you know, there's this expectation that all children will reach or should reach a certain stage, a certain level at a certain age. Anyone who doesn't gets left behind. You know, they stop dancing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
When actually the reality is that, well, maybe it's just got to kick in at some point, because by going dancing, you're learning about dancing. and you're not as advanced as your other half is, because she's presumably done a lot more dancing than you have.
Yeah, I think, but what I learned is I was in the wrong class. I managed to learn that within the first hour.
Yeah, or maybe you just don't want to do it.
Yeah, but that's conflating wanting to do something with ultimately showing some sort of acumen for doing it. I mean, it's like this idea everyone's got a book in them. That may be true, but how, depending on why they're doing it, but how good that book is.
Yeah.
Is another point. You know, one of the interesting things, I don't know if you find, I don't know how much, do you get much feedback on your podcast generally?
I get little bits and pieces here and there. Not a major amount, but I do get, you know, it's fairly positive. So I know I've got some people who do listen to all of them.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's, you know, I suppose people aren't generally inclined to give feedback, are they?
As a writer, you get, if you're lucky, you get feedback in reviews. And it's really interesting because the people who like what you do say this is great. And the people who don't like what you do, or as I call them, American readers, they now against Americans, people who know I'm a failed American myself.
Yeah.
But the people who don't like it, really don't like it. What I'm interested in, I mean, obviously you weather that as part of the process. If you're putting yourself out there, then you're not setting yourself up as a target, but you realize that people are going to project onto you. I've had people who say they're quite vicious in their condemnation of my literary ability, and that's their freedom. You know, they've paid their money. Yep. I have no issue with that. But what's interesting for me as a creative person is that you're always, hopefully, you're always trying to push yourself, not just beyond your comfort zone, but you're looking to improve.
Yes.
But there will be a point where, both stylistically and in terms of ability, you reach that plateau that you're not really going to go much above, where you kind of go, this is how I write, this is how it is. And for me, I mean, I've done a series of five books, or one of the series, and I'm working on book six now. And there's a part of you that thinks, I want to do this differently, I want to twist it or change it or surprise people. And there's another part that says, no, this is how you do it, and you're writing for the majority of that audience that like what you're doing.
Yes.
Interesting dynamic. I mean, I'm not sure there's an answer to it.
I don't think there is, because I think when you get it, you know, if you look at the people at the top, at some point they're meeting this standard that's been set. You know, restaurant critics, literary critics, you know, art critics. There's an establishment at play, isn't there? Decides what's good and what's not. I think things have changed because now it's much easier to get content out there.
Yeah.
To get, you know, you can self-publish and you can just jump onto an app and do a podcast like I do. But I think for me, it's like the podcast is a good example. I do that first and foremost for me. And if people like it, then that's fantastic. I'm happy if, you know, 5-10 people listen to it, great. And they enjoy it or not, you know, it's up to them. But I think, you know, my whole journey, I hate that word, but over the last sort of, I think all the work I've done on myself, and I said this to myself, and it was 5 years ago, it's like, this is all about finding my voice. So it's no surprise that I've gone into, you know, the auditory world. You know, so like even today, it's like, you know, you talked about videoing this, and it's like, no, that's a distraction for me, because that's not where my focus, my interest is.
No, I can totally get that. I mean, I've used that old joke that I have a face for radio, but I'm much happier talking. I did a talk 2-3 months ago, and I was talking about an aspect of creativity in front of a real audience. They hadn't come to see me per se. I mean, I was just one of the speakers, and it was really interesting. Firstly, it's something I haven't done in years, and certainly not to an audience of about 50 people. I used to do the kind of corporate-y stuff where you do a presentation. And then there came a point, my version of it is, there came a point where it was agreed that I wouldn't do any more presentations because it wasn't supposed to be amateur comedy night. I was actually told by someone genuinely, you should do comedy in your own time, which I thought was lovely. That was my proudest moment. But it was interesting speaking in front of an audience. And once you get over the fact that they're looking at you, but they're not really looking at you, hopefully they're paying attention. They might have been just checking their phones. But it sort of reconnected me with the love of communication, the randomness, the interconnectedness. People came up to me afterwards. Actually, all the people who liked the talk, all three of them, were either writers or, in one case, a creative writing tutor. So they got what I was saying. I don't know if you feel that when you're doing a podcast, because you know that lots of people listen to you, but you still get that same buzz because you know that somewhere you're making an impact, even if it's just distracting someone from a terrible day for 5 minutes.
Yeah, and I think that's the feedback that really keeps me going, because I do get a few of those.
Yeah.
You know, those sort of comments that are like, I don't think you realise the impact you've had. It's just silly little, you might have even said that before. So I call it a silly little 5 minute podcast, but actually, no, it's not. It's the essence of me that I'm talking about some serious stuff, some deep stuff, but it's kind of lighthearted. It's just skipping down. And it's interesting. Yeah. You're talking about, you know, you're doing those talks. There's this need to take things seriously, and it pisses me off. It's like, why do we have to take the when I was doing the sports stuff, you know, I've had that with clients before. It's like, yeah, you know, I got to a point where I realized I needed to take it seriously, and I'm like, why? Because you're losing all that fun that, you know, playing football, that when you were a kid, keep hold of that, you know, the joy of doing it, keep hold of that, because that's what great sportsmen do. I think, you know, like the Lionel Messi, he plays with a joy, doesn't he?
Well, he plays with joy, but I mean that's the other art and commerce conversation, isn't it? You're in the, I don't know, fortunate is the right word, you're in a position in your life where the thing that you love to do at the moment is not required to be a source of income.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
I've made that transition somewhat. You know, I work as a freelancer, I don't have an employer anymore, and I have an expectation, rightly or wrongly, that my books will earn me some money.
Yeah.
That doesn't change what I write, and sadly it hasn't made me write any faster, but it is inevitably a consideration where perhaps there are some things I might think about, oh, I'd quite like to. I mean, I've got ideas for about 4 or 5 books, as I think I always say to people, there's always a firework display going on in my head. Also, it's an age thing as well. You know, I'm in my 50s. I wouldn't necessarily devote the time required if I couldn't see, I don't mean success in terms of critical acclaim or money, but I wouldn't write them unless I thought there would be an outcome that I'd be happy with, i.e. an audience to read them.
Yeah, I suppose that's often the challenge, isn't it? And it's almost like with my podcast, I don't know if I'd want to earn any money from it, because then the challenge is to continue to do what you do for the reasons you do it and not do them for other people's reasons. So not start writing books to please an audience.
The thing that I like best about your podcast, and I'm happy to say this in this recording because then you've got no control over it, is the authenticity. If you're having a crap day, you say it's a bit of a crap day. Sometimes, often, you're very funny without meaning to be, but it's authentically you. And going back to what you were saying about art, whether it's music, literature, cinema, it does seem like there are arbiters of taste and gatekeepers. I listened to it, I can't remember the name of the band, but I think it was a 9-minute song. I was watching Pointless. They reference one of the obscure answers for some band which I hadn't heard of, Alex someone or other. I'll put a link on yours. Yeah. And I listened to this song, it went on for about 9 minutes, and it was guitar, it was just everywhere. It was a bit of jazz, a bit of screaming guitar. It was amazing. Yeah. And it was,
yeah,
I was sort of riveted, just sat in front of my computer listening to this, thinking, I'm not surprised I never heard of this band, because obviously they were never going to get album success, but they did this song, and it exists, and aficionados of the band, whose name I can't remember, will obviously treasure this. And I thought, that is so good to do something so distinctive. 40 years later, someone can listen to it and go, wow.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, what you're describing is people, sounds like it anyway, that, you know, people doing that for the hell of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, even listening to that podcast with Stuart Lee, I mean, you know, he was saying about, you know, the reason he does things on his own is because he's not prepared to relinquish that control, which enables him to not have to control it. You know, he doesn't have to consider anything but what he wants to do. People off sometimes, that's why he's a bit Marmite, I think.
Obviously there's a lot of luck in these things, but it does seem that if you stick to your guns, even when your guns rotate a bit, you will end up somewhere. That might not be financial success, that might not be critical acclaim, it might be a book that other people find unreadable.
Yeah.
You'll sort of be your authentic self, you'll produce something that's distinctive because it's come from your own journey. That's something we don't teach kids or adults, come to that.
No, just to do things for the hell of it. And again, I think, you know, sports is a good example. You think about those great sports people, they were just out, you know, footballers, Paul Gascoigne, just kicking a ball all the time.
Yeah.
You know, without any, you know, they might have had these dreams of being a professional footballer one day, but they're kind of childish dreams, aren't they? You know, I suppose I'm starting to to get a sense of my own purpose. And, you know, it's like, I don't enjoy writing. I don't enjoy creating things on computers. This is about me making change with my words. That's the phrase I've got at the moment. My podcast is a platform to do that in my small corner of the world, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe that will turn into something bigger, but there's a reluctance to for it to be too successful, certainly financially.
Yeah, it does change things. I mean, I know some writers, if you like, would-be authors, who say I do it for the love of it and I don't want that to change. I don't know that it's A or B. Inevitably, I think your view of yourself when you start getting some money for the thing that you've done for love, but your view of yourself and what you've done inevitably alters because your experience changes. You know, so now I can say, and I still cringe when I say this, I don't know why, oh, my publisher, blah, blah, blah. And other writers, you know, oh, got a publisher, have we? They don't actually speak to me like that, but that's how it is in my head. That changes how you see yourself. But then I would argue that it's good not to see yourself in a fixed sense anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, because I've recorded most of the episodes over the park.
Yeah.
This is a park that has been a part of my entire life almost. And when I've moved away from the area and back again, but this is the park that I used to play in as a kid and hang out with my mates and all that kind of stuff. So it's almost like it roots me. It's an anchor to and I've talked about this a lot about the, it's an anchor to the 8-year-old me. My granddad died when I was 8, if you remember. Well, died the day before my 9th birthday. So I became this, I don't know, somber 9-year-old and then carried that through my life. So this is all, there's a reason why I go over the park. And it's not, it's partly because actually I know I talk more freely when I'm moving, you know. So in jobs, I remember I worked for a company that had 13 buildings and I'd get on a phone call and then kind of end up bloody miles away in another building. So there's that, there's a freedom to it. I just wander about with my clown phone. But I think there is a lot of what I've done over the last 10 years has been reconnecting with that 8-year-old Dave and becoming a 54 nearly year old version of that Dave rather than the miserable 9-year-old, you know.
And do you think the podcast has kind of helped you do that?
Yeah, I think so. And even, I mean, this right now, this is almost kind of, it's weird how I've decided to change the format slightly today.
Yeah.
And then we're doing this today. So this is almost a bit of a, I don't know, it feels like I'm drawing a line under the previous 213 episodes. And now I go off somewhere else.
Well, I think the line is a kind of an incline going up, because everything you've done before takes you forward to something else. That's all.
No, absolutely. But you know, when I say draw a line, I don't mean you know, leave it behind. It's still a continuation, but it's, I don't know, maybe that's the wrong, maybe this is just a bit of a synopsis of what I've achieved and what I've got from those, you know, the first 200 or so episodes. And now I'm going off in a different direction. And I recorded one today and it felt a little bit, this isn't familiar. So again, I'm now in a, I don't know, I suppose I'm back into learning mode, getting out of my comfort zone a bit. That applies to anything, writing, music,
yeah,
whatever
definitely.
It might be.
Because there needs to be an element, I think there's an element of inward focus, because I think when you create anything, podcast, music, literature, cinema, you're in part drawing on your own experience because you're present. And there's also there is, I think, always, perhaps less so for you, I don't know, a kind of outward eye where you're looking at the finished product and wondering how it will be perceived. But there needs to be a kind of closed loop, which is the learning, like the AI. Does this work? No, do this instead. Does that work? No, do something else instead. And I think for as a writer, what I've learned of late is that it needs to be more fun.
Yeah. What you mean the process?
The process, but also the whole, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying, oh, it's so terrible being a writer, far from it, it's great. But the whole experience of the communication thing. So recently I've applied to a couple of places to appear as a guest speaker after doing this event, because I thought, you know, I'm enjoying this. This is interesting. The feedback and some of the questions at the end, some of which were not critical, but just curious. Why is this? Are you saying this? Are you saying that? And I thought, I like that dialogue because it keeps me on my toes.
Yep.
Writing books is great, but it's very much a one-sided process. And then if you're lucky, you get someone contact you and say, I really liked your book because, or even, I really didn't like your book. The joy of it, I think, is what is really important. So I'm totally with you on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's the reason for, you know, I did an episode probably a few days ago. It was just sort of a review of, you know, my values, freedom, exploration, creativity. And that's the reason why I keep doing this, even on the days when I don't really feel like it. because it satisfies those things that are most important to me.
Do you feel now that it's an itch you must scratch? So if you, the idea of missing it for a day would be, I don't know.
Unpalatable. I couldn't.
Unpalatable, now. Yeah, I couldn't think of the word.
Yeah, I couldn't now. So I do have days where, I'm up early, I've had days when I can't sleep and I've got out at 3 o'clock in the morning and done it. I think over time what I've found is I'm more inclined just to buckle up and do it as early in the day as possible.
What do the people around you think, you know, your friends, family, about the are they aware of the podcast then, or are they
they all know I do one, but they don't pay any attention to it. But I think that's quite normal, because I'm husband, dad, whatever I am to them, so they don't see me in that way. I'm just, you know, they just, I don't know, they don't trivialize it as such, but there's just not really any interest in it, and that's fine, because actually it's better that they're not.
I know what you mean. I mean, my partner reads my books, and she's firm but fair. I do actually use her as a sounding board, so I'll say we'll go on walks, and I'll start going on about my anxiety and woes for a person who doesn't exist, who exists solely in my head.
Yeah.
And I'll do the same on my own. I'll go walking up the lane, chatting to myself. I actually find it's interesting what you're saying about the movement, because I find going for walks the best way to unlock plot and character issues. I don't know if it's because your part of your brain is distracted because you don't want to crash into hedges, but I find it really helpful.
I think that's part of it, you know. It's sort of meditation by movement, so that is it for me. It's almost, you know, if you're stuck with something, move. If you're sitting at a desk writing and you're stuck, then just go, just go and jump around or have a dance. Not in your case, obviously, because you can't.
No, I really can't.
You know, but just it's just breaking that kind of breaking the state that you're in into something more creative. You know, people have ideas in the shower. We've all had those experiences. So I think it's often, you know, go and do something that you don't have to think about too much, that occupies as many of your senses as possible. Almost, you're moving, so you're using, you know, you're feeling something just by walking. You've got stuff to look at, you know, so it's almost like it distracts all your senses. I mean, running, so I don't run much at the moment, but I've done it a lot in the past, and that was the best thing for me, because you can't really think about much else when you're running.
No,
just, so you know, I suppose it frees up your mind to do whatever it needs to do without you logically thinking about it.
Oh, we're going to close, I think, with a quote from you. I don't know what. As a reader, an occasional reader, an often reader, what are the worst things about books that will turn you off?
Blimey.
I didn't know where I was going with that either. So that's
that's a tough question. Just trying to think. I don't know what even makes me. I think I read a lot of books that are on recommendation. So I've got a friend who I don't see that often, but we've gone through periods where we just recommend books to one another.
Yeah.
And we've got a similar sense of humour. I haven't got an answer for that, weirdly. I don't actually buy many books that I don't read, and I don't force myself to read books anymore. Do you know what I mean? I don't force myself to finish a book.
So you're quite careful in the selection process.
Yes, but then I'm not a particularly voracious reader at the moment. So, you know, I don't go and buy a bunch of books and they sit around for ages and eventually I read them. I'll go out and buy a book to read and I'll read it.
And then it's done and then it's out the door.
So get one done and then move on to the next one. Although I know I've said I've got a few non-fiction books knocking about, but that's just because I've gone out of the non-fiction phase.
Right.
And I'm now just in a non-reading phase at the moment. It's interesting that I can't answer that question.
I've never thought about it for myself, but I thought I'd ask you because you're a kind of zingy ideas person. So I thought, I wonder what will occur. So that will remain a mystery.
Drawn a blank. Or I might think of the answer and I'll let you know.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks very much for your time. And
I've enjoyed it.
It's been great. I'll let you know when it's on air.
I'll catch you soon.
And just to remind people, podcast is the Bullshit Detective, 5-minute podcast and some 1-hour ones, which are very interesting indeed.
Thank you very much. Very kind.
Speak to you soon.
Yeah.